Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Remix Sydney. Please welcome to the stage Microsoft Australia's Michael Kodahi and Shane Morris.
Good morning, everyone. Well, when we wrapped up Remix last year in Melbourne, we said we wanted to dedicate the keynote this year to all the awesome work Australians are doing in Silverlight, in WPF, and Windows Live, and you certainly didn't let us down. So before we go any further, I think you guys should congratulate yourselves and your colleagues for all the awesome Australian work we just saw in the Remix Highlights video. So good morning and welcome to the beautiful Coles Theatre. I feel like I'm in the inside of a cake. And welcome to Remix 08. I don't think we need to tell you guys that we are sold out. That's not a phrase we usually like to use in relation to Microsoft. But awesome for Remix here in Sydney for the first time. And speaking of sold out, a big shout out to our hombres over in the overflow room. Everyone wave to the people in the other room.
Other room, are you there?
Awesome.
So thanks for coming, guys and girls. That's Shane, I'm Michael. I had three observations yesterday that I want to share really quickly. The first, it's all Aussie speakers. Everything you're going to see today, or bar a couple of Americans, you're going to see a whole bunch of Aussies who are the experts in their field. So feel free to, during their sessions, after their sessions, pick their brains. And these guys are the Aussie experts in the areas that they're talking about today. So I think that's the coolest thing. It's good to see that it's a bunch of Aussies who are the experts in the fields that you're going to see them talk about. The other thing I'm excited about is you saw a couple of snippets in there. We're going to show you a couple of things that you probably haven't seen before. Well, not probably, for sure haven't seen before. So a couple of Australian big brands who've done really innovative stuff, and they're going to come up here and demo and show you the stuff they've done. And the third, it looks like, just based on the registration, so we've got a good mix of creatives and developers, which I think is pretty cool.
So speaking of creative and technical, I think we need to do the obligatory show of hands. So starting with my creative peeps, so if you're a user experience person, if you're a designer, if you just do page layout, put your hands up now. Don't be afraid, you're amongst friends.
I'll do that.
Awesome. Designers are still a new audience for Microsoft, so we're really grateful that you came along today. We've got some terrific stuff to show you in the creative track.
I do think it's quite cute that he's putting a show of hands up. Can I see developer hands?
Yeah, just raise your pocket protectors in the air, guys.
That's awesomeness.
Cool. And I guess that's what Remix is all about, right?
It is.
Bringing together the right combination of creative, technical, and business considerations to deliver awesome products and services in a spirit of learning from each other and cross-collaboration. And it's in that spirit of learning from others that we've invited our keynote along today. And so I think I'll leave the stage and let Cordsy do the introductions.
Cool. Well, I won't take up too much of his time. Our special guest speaker today is Mark Pesce. If you don't know Mark, Mark is a futurist. He's an inventor. He's an author. He's the panelist of the New Inventors, amongst myriads of other things. And Mark's really here to talk about hyper-empowerment and what that means. I won't even pretend to be able to intro him. So I reckon it's best that we ask Mark to come up and give him some time. Mark.
Good morning, everybody. And just to clear up a comment Michael made, in 6 months I'll be a fine Aussie. So there you go. All right, let's start off with a little message from the future.
The local news of the week. At midnight Saturday, the telephones in this city will be changed to dial service, and all telephone numbers will be changed. Late this week, new directories will be delivered. Here are a few important suggestions for the use of your dial telephone. Before calling any number, first secure the number from your new directory. Then remove the receiver and listen for the dial tone. It sounds like this. That tone indicates everything is ready for your call. With the receiver off the hook, dial the desired number. For example, suppose you want to dial 23650. Dial each numeral in this manner, pulling the dial around to the finger stop each time. Be sure to allow the dial to freely return to its normal position. And this is the ringing signal. If the line is busy, you'll hear this busy signal. Until Saturday midnight, please use your present directory and make your calls in the usual manner.
So we're going to talk about connecting, dialing each other this morning. Let me start off with talking about something that you're all familiar with. So a week ago yesterday, 2:28 in the afternoon in China, 7.9 earthquake in Sichuan province. And the earthquake was felt over an incredibly broad area. And so when the shaking stopped, what did the Chinese do? Well, China now has the largest population of internet users in the world. They passed the United States in March. They have over 220 million internet users. So what they did is they actually went online to find out what the heck had just happened. Now, all of us do all sorts of different things online. We do very utilitarian things online. For instance, we do our electronic banking, or we do flight reservations. We do work tasks online, and we answer queries from our coworkers and whatnot. But the other thing that we're now doing online is that we're using the internet to expand and to deepen our social lives. Now, it wasn't supposed to be like this. This is what the internet was supposed to turn us into. It was supposed to turn us into dropouts living in our parents' basements, living a furtive existence online, because we'd withdrawn from contact with the cruel, cruel world. But in reality, something very, very different is taking place right now, because we're reaching out through the wire. We're reaching our families, we're reaching our friends, we're reaching our coworkers, and just about now, we're starting to reach people that we'll never meet in the flesh. So, we touch every one of these people with acts of communication. To our family, we send loves and kisses, and to our friends, we probably send a joke or a link to a video. To a coworker, we send them a link to a report that they might need, and for everyone else, well, we'll come to that. But every time we reach out and every time we have that act of communication, we reinforce the bonds that connect us to other people. Now, this is not a new thing. It's not even something that's unique to human beings, because gorillas and chimpanzees do this as well. This reaching out to share something that we know or something that we think or something that we found or something that we believe, that sharing, that act of sharing, it's a basic part of every one of us. Sharing makes the world go round. And just now, just in the last year or two, we've gotten very, very good at sharing. So, I've only been in Australia 4.5 years. 4.5 years ago, there were very few technologies of sharing, and just now we started to see Flickr. So you can upload a photo to Flickr and share it with absolutely everyone on Earth. YouTube, we all know what YouTube is. It's where I got that funny video from. It's the third most trafficked site on the web. And now there's Twitter. Now, how many of you have Twitter accounts? Okay, so just a few of you. It's still breaking right now. And Twitter allows me to send little messages called tweets to a select range of people who are called followers. Now, I call Twitter a social messaging service. That is, another SMS, all right? And it allows me to communicate the same sorts of things that I'd be communicating in a text message, but rather than going to just one person, it goes to 450 people who have decided they want to listen to what I have to say. Now, many of these people I know, either in person or by reputation, and in fact, I've met a couple of you in the flesh for the first time this morning, and they follow me because they're interested in what I might have to say about something. But most of the conversation on Twitter is inane. It's like the world's sort of weirdest, longest-running cocktail party. But some of it is incredibly vital, and some of it is incredibly important. For example, last Monday, I was leaving the house to go to Interesting South last Monday, and just before I left the house, I received a few tweets about this earthquake in China. What earthquake, I wondered, because there was nothing on BBC, there was nothing on Sydney Morning Herald, there was nothing on the New York Times, there was nothing on CNN. What earthquake are these folks talking about? And even the Associated Press hadn't burped up a report about this. Now, I have one follower, and that's him, that's Dedrick Lam, he lives in Shanghai. Everyone in Shanghai felt the shaking of the earthquake. And once the shaking had stopped, they connected with one another. And did you feel that? Yes, I felt that. Did you feel that? Yes, I felt that. It happened over and over and over. And they started to receive messages and tweets from further around China. And so they could say, oh yeah, we felt it over here in Beijing. Oh yeah, we felt it over here in Hong Kong. But also what became clear is that no one was getting any messages from Sichuan. And all of this, they figured out within a few minutes, and they figured it out 30 minutes before anything about the earthquake made its way onto the wire. Now, when I met up with friends at Interesting South, I said, hey, have you heard about the earthquake in China? They said, what earthquake? What are you talking about? Now, Twitter, which can now transcend sort of the boundaries of politics and culture and language as a social messaging service, because it connects us by bounds of affinity, it's become, very accidentally, a human early warning system. So one tweet, if I'd gotten it just about an earthquake, that might not be a ring of truth. Maybe someone's trying to spoof me. But if I'm getting 1,000 tweets from all different directions, that's got the ring of truth. Now, by the time I got back to my flat about 5 hours later on Monday evening, the Twitter sphere was absolutely alive with tweets from people in China. They were passing along all the latest news reports, video clips, photographs, everything that was going on the front line of the rescue effort as they were pulling people out of the collapsed buildings. And on Tuesday, I was sitting at home working, Dedrick Lam posted probably 100 tweets, which all came in to my Twitter account. And I took the best of those and then retweeted them. That's basically, I just forwarded them along to the 400 people who are following me. That human network of connections gave everyone who was following us a better and more complete picture of what was going on China on Tuesday than anything that you could get from BBC or CNN or the New York Times or anyone else. Because those news organizations were trying to drop reporters into the earthquake zone, but they couldn't do it because there was no way to do it. Instead, these folks were in the earthquake zone, and if they had power and if they had connectivity, they were sending the messages out into the human network, and as long as it hit one point in the human network, it fanned out and started to cover the world. Now, some of the stories that he covered were uplifting. There were stories of people being rescued from collapsed buildings, and some of them broke your heart. And if you are sensitive, I'm about to show a photograph. I'll let you know when the photograph's gone, but you may want to turn away because this is a very sad photograph. But Dedrick posted that one along there. And there's just, you can't say anything, but that one came out on Tuesday because that's what was really going on in China. All right, you can come and look back at the screen again. Our ability to reach out and to touch other people and to be touched by them over matters that are trivial or matters that are life and death has grown so suddenly and so completely and so comprehensively that it's changing the way we think and the way we work and the way we live our lives, all right? We are now hyper-connected. Yeah, very good. The social message service isn't really just a fun way to while away the time, just sort of chatting with your friends. It's not even a great way to stay informed. It's the way that we're going to do business in the 21st century. So, part two, instant karma. That's Michael Arrington. He runs the TechCrunch blog. Many of you probably read it. And he was having a lousy weekend, the first weekend of April, because his cable provider, Comcast, which is also his internet provider, had gone dark. And he kept on calling Comcast to find out what was going wrong, and he kept on getting a different explanation every time. I'm sure this has never happened to any of you. Well, he finally decided, I've had enough of this, and he starts stealing some neighbor's Wi-Fi. And after 30 hours of putting up with crap, he posts a tweet. You can read it, it's the top tweet there. Because he'd really kind of had enough. Arrington has 17,000 followers on Twitter. 17,000 people read that message, and all of a sudden, all sorts of chatter started. And 20 minutes later, an executive at Comcast calls Michael Arrington and says, "I've heard about your problem. What can we do to fix it for you?" And over the course of the conversation, it turns out that this executive who's doing customer service actually monitors Twitter for mentions of Comcast, so he can nip problems in the bud. All right. Now, Arrington is famous and very influential in the technology circles, but Josh Lowenson isn't. And Josh Lowenson was having some trouble installing software for a cable modem that he'd gotten from Comcast, and was really just sort of sick of having to deal with the software and posted a tweet about it. And 20 minutes later, he gets a call from Comcast. You don't have to be famous. You don't have to be well-known. You don't even have to be particularly well-connected if the company is listening. And they gave him the solution to his problem, and he wrote this beautiful, loving blog post about it. And, you know, that kind of post you can't pay for. That's real authentic customer love. It's the best thing imaginable. And that's the kind of weapon that Twitter provides us, that hyperconnectivity provides us. But that kind of weapon can be pointed both ways. So this is my friend Gregory. He's a very good friend of mine, and he's a consultant, and he works with a range of different companies basically talking about social media. And he gave a presentation to a company last month. And the presentation had been organized by the staff, the managing director of this company. Now, if you are a consultant, you know, because I do this myself, you often get invited in by senior staff to break news to the managing director that they don't want to tell themselves because they don't have the cojones for it. So you hire a consultant to hide behind them. And we also know that some managing directors like to shoot the messenger. And this is exactly what happened. After this very good presentation about the value of social media and their business, the managing director went bananas, peppered him with accusations. "Are you trying to steal from my company? I can't believe you did this." And so the meeting just sort of falls apart after that, and he tweets from his mobile because you can send an SMS to Twitter. God, my God, that meeting went really, really poorly. And I read the tweet immediately and found out what had happened. Now, this is when I had a real penny drop moment. My friend Gregory was just starting on Twitter at the time. He had only 9 different people who were following him. But 2 of those people, myself and Raven Zachary, are really well connected. Raven has about 700 followers, and I'm closing on 500. And both of us are very well connected technology professionals. And both of us have opinions that people rely on. And so what I realized was that if we had spread the word of the behavior of that managing director, we would be able to bring that company to its knees. All right? They would be unable to hire qualified technology workers because the word would be out on the street in a minute about that bad behavior. We could trigger the nuclear option if we wanted to, and that stupid MD would pay the price in full for her stupidity, and it would all be over in just a few minutes. I call that instant karma. Now, all of this, the examples good and bad, means that we need new tools, all right? We need better tools that will be able to read the collective mind of the internet, because trust me, Twitter is the closest thing we've got to a collective mind, which means it is silly and inane and ridiculous and surrealistic, but also often truthful and valuable. And you have to be able to sort out between those two. Now, everyone needs this ability, and we're growing the tools for this, but big businesses, big corporations, big organizations need it desperately because customers can now organize themselves against those firms at the press of a button. And rumors can destroy markets inside of an afternoon, and bad behavior can no longer be covered up. But this isn't just a warning call. This is an opportunity. Because the same techniques of social sharing that we're using in our day-to-day lives are almost never used inside companies, all right? You've got email, and if you're very, very lucky, you maybe have instant messaging. But to give the employees a central line where they could collectively gripe or muse or collaborate, that's beyond the pale. It's too much freedom, and it gives you too much opportunity to organize against corporate stupidity. As if sharing your mind and building up esprit de corps were unproductive. There's a disconnect between the way we do business and the way we're living life in the real world. And right now, outside the corporate cubicle, things are changing so rapidly that it's making us a little bit dizzy. But down on the cube farm, things are pretty much the same as they ever were. And the longer this goes, the more dangerous the situation becomes, because these companies, your jobs, their customers, all of them are now tottering on a knife edge, where a single word in the wrong place at the wrong time can blow it all away. But if you build tools to allow this kind of sharing to take place, you can access the correct collective capabilities of your organization and you can turbocharge it. But you're going to have to grasp the nettle, and you're going to have to change all of these potential negatives into game-changing positives. Let's take a look at how. Now, the web is more than just words on a page. That's how things started. And it's not just a funny video embedded in a blog. The web actually isn't about content. I know we've been told for years that content is king. It is not. Connection is king. Now, 12 years ago, connection and sharing meant creating a web page with an animated GIF background and a bad MIDI soundtrack and 4,000 pictures of your kitty cat. And don't tell me you didn't see them, because I know you did. And while that still goes on today, it's not the main event. It's a sideshow. Sharing and connecting has evolved into something new, more than just a way to unburden yourself. So, in January 2001, Jimmy Wales opened up his failed encyclopedia called Newpedia to outside contributions. And he had no idea that for the next 2 years, people would work away tirelessly, adding articles on every topic under the sun. And they would correct the grammatical and spelling mistakes of others. And they would do that for article after article. And they would even borrow from the 1913 copy of Encyclopedia Britannica to cover subjects that they didn't know themselves. Now, when I saw Wikipedia, which was in January of 2002, it had about 15,000 articles on a fairly broad range of subjects. It wasn't bad, but it's not encyclopedic. That's about the size of a child's encyclopedia. But it was respectable enough after a year of work on the hot part of the Wikipedians. But even those 15,000 articles were enough because people dropped by to use it, and they might find something they needed, and they might correct something. And if they found it useful, they'd be more likely to drop by again and maybe add something. And if they found that useful, they might be more likely to drop by again and create an article. And they'd be most likely to tell their friends about this. And so you have a virtuous cycle forming where the contributions breed a real respect and a love and affection for Wikipedia, which breeds increased usage, which breeds increased contributions, and so on. And so as of yesterday, Wikipedia has 2,376,000 articles in English. So in just half a decade, Wikipedia has become the definitive reference in the English language, and it's displaced the 250-year-old Encyclopedia Britannica, which has just 1/9 of the number of articles. Now, Wikipedia is not perfect, and we all know that, but neither is Britannica. Both of them are, on average, equally accurate. But Wikipedia is available anywhere, freely, anytime, through any connection to the Internet. And imagine this. As a child, my parents gave me a copy of the World Book Encyclopedia, 20 volumes. I read it over the course of probably a couple of years because, you know, when you're a kid, you read the encyclopedia, right? A child today could never read all of Wikipedia because articles are being added so quickly now that you'd always be forever falling behind. Now, in Wikipedia, we have a standard factual reference in English. But what's that given us? It depends on how you use it. If you're a student, you're probably using it against teacher's strict instructions to help you write a paper, all right? Or you might use it to settle a trivia dispute that arises at a dinner party. Or if you were smart, you might use the factual information to make better decisions, okay? In truth, we have such a wealth of knowledge available to us in Wikipedia that we should think of it as a part of our brains that's just basically right outside of our heads. If we used it consistently as a reference, we would make fewer mistakes. Because there's an old song, a Mark Twain quote that goes, "It's not what you don't know, it's what you know that ain't so." So for all of the factual questions of our lives, we now have answers. We just need to put those answers to work. And if we leverage the knowledge that right now is securely locked away in our head, the knowledge that, as you can see in the example of Wikipedia, we're able to share with one another now, we can increase our own intelligence. We can increase our capability to make better decisions. We can improve our effectiveness, both as individuals and as organizations. And that's a basic innovation. It's probably the most important innovation of the 21st century. And it has enormous implications for organizations of all sorts, because organizations thrive on information and on knowledge. So every trade, from the most physical trade to the most abstract trade, it relies on the expertise and the knowledge of those who practice it. We apprentice young people so they can come up to speed in all of that knowledge. We send them to uni and we send them to postgraduate schools so that we can bring them up to speed in that. And now we have tools which can accelerate and improve that transmission of knowledge with the technologies of sharing. Now, sometimes text is the best medium for the transmission of knowledge, but that really isn't always the case, because video and audio and animations and photographs often work far more effectively. For example, you can find an article in Wikipedia on the history of baking, but if you want to bake a cake, you probably want to go to YouTube. So, consider Wikipedia and think about how to apply it to your own organizations. And ask yourself this question: can you improve the effectiveness of your organization's abilities to make decisions, to react quickly to a changing environment, and to innovate, to constantly reinvent itself? All right? Those are the challenges facing all organizations in the 21st century, both in the commercial and in the private sectors of the economy. Now, we have tools that allow us to improve our effectiveness. We can hyper-empower organizations and individuals if we put those tools to work. But you need to develop the tools which provide hyper-connectivity. And you need to provide systems which take people who have been hyper-connected and allow them to pool their expertise. It's a two-stage process. Connect and then share. It could, at some level, be as simple as a combination of Twitter and Wikipedia. All right, just those two pieces, custom crafted for your organization, put them together and they will create a revolution in any organization where they're introduced. But when you start adding rich media, when you start capturing everything which can't easily be expressed in text, then you start to build up a reservoir of expertise. And that reservoir of expertise provides a foundation for excellence and provides the launch pad for a rocket ship ride into hyper-empowerment. Now, here's the point. You actually already know how to do this, because when you leave the cubicle and you go home and go online, you already do all of these things. You already know how to put these tools to work. You use these tools every single day, but they haven't yet transformed the organization. And they will. Right now, almost anything is possible. We're at a cusp. We're just learning how to be hyperconnected now. So we have this enormous open field where anything is possible, and almost anything will be tried out to see if it really, really works. So we're at a cusp of an explosion of innovation. And you have the tools to drive that innovation. And your organizations need this to happen if they're going to continue to thrive in the 21st century. So it's up to you. It's up to every one of you, the designers and the developers, because you've got to go hand in hand. You have to go down into the code mines, you have to go down into the user testing labs, and you have to make this happen. You can lead the way. You can empower me. You can empower all of us. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Mark. I'm feeling hyper-empowered already. I don't know about you guys. The rest of the keynote today, we need to take you through what Microsoft has been up to over the last year in terms of the web, platforms, tools, services. We're going to talk Silverlight, of course. We're going to talk IE, Windows Live, and also Expression. my favorite. But I think we should start at the top. There's been a lot of announcements, a lot of buzz around Silverlight lately, new features, new releases, and I can think of many, many people more qualified to talk about Silverlight than Michael Kodahi.
Thank you. I pretend to know something about Silverlight, so let me know if I don't. Are we on top of Silverlight? A unanimous maybe? All right. So I'll give you guys a brief catch-up of where we are in case you haven't been paying attention in great detail over the last couple of months around what's happening around Silverlight. So you know Silverlight 2 is in beta. You know the difference between Silverlight 2 and Silverlight 1. We're going to go into it a little bit. But essentially, the fundamental thing about Silverlight 2 is it's all about developers. One was all about media and media scenarios. Two is all about development and platform functionality, and we'll go through that in a second. So, and it's about building interactive experiences and applications, where one was purely around media. So things you might know, things you might not know. Silverlight 1 is out, has been out for a while. Silverlight 2, it's currently in beta 1. It will have a go-live sometime before the Beijing Olympics. So you know that the NBC in the US are doing their entire media experience in Silverlight, and that's a key driver for the release of 2. So we'll have beta 2 out by the time the Olympics is ready, probably even sooner. And then sometime after the Olympics, release to web, the release of 2. The key thing about beta 2 is that it's going to have a go-live license attached to it, so you guys can go out and make Silverlight lovin'. And the other thing that you might have missed or might not have missed is the... is a bit more about... let's go straight to it. This thing. I don't know if you paid attention. In about March, we announced that we're going to do it on the mobile and that Nokia is going to do it on the mobile too. So Silverlight will come to mobile. Nokia is going to put it on their S60s, their S40s, and their tablets. So they've announced a partnership with us that they're going to make that happen. So it's pretty exciting. All these different target platforms for the one application code. A lot of people ask about the... the download rate, so you probably are most interested in, if you're building stuff in Silverlight, what's going to happen when visitors come to the site. You want a high degree of confidence that there's going to be a high amount of people with it installed already. We announced the number in March. So 1.5 million installs a day of Silverlight, which I actually think is pretty high for a product that's been around almost a year. You can use your mathematical skills and figure out the rest of that equation. So the key things that are happening in 2, I won't go into them, I won't go... into detail. So there are sessions later on today all about Silverlight 2. There are two key ones. There's one very developer-focused that Phil Beadle's delivering, and one right after this in this room talking about the user experience side of Silverlight 2. Probably the biggest single thing about 2 is that it's got .NET on the client. So you'll be able to build applications using your favorite .NET languages and a whole bunch of database-y kind of stuff, right? So link to XML... connecting to web services, data binding, and all that sort of goodness. We've also included controls. So if anyone used 1, you're probably a little bit disappointed. There were no controls. We're now putting in data grids and buttons and the stuff you'd expect to be there. So it's transforming Silverlight into an application platform. So that's the fundamental difference. Is if you're a .NET developer today, you'll be at home in Silverlight building richer experiences. But wait, there's more. There's that thing up the top. There's a whole bunch of networking stack stuff that you probably expect as .NET developers to happen. Adaptive streaming, I think, is the most interesting one in that stack. Adaptive streaming is when you have media and the bandwidth is dropping, as it does in Australia, is that the stream adapts itself so that the experience maintains itself and there are no cutouts in the video experience. And the other biggie is Deep Zoom. Have we seen Deep Zoom? Oh, geez, you guys are asleep. Yay, cool. Cookie for you. Deep Zoom's like the coolest thing ever. If you knew Sea Dragon, Deep Zoom is what Sea Dragon was, but it's built into Silverlight 2. Jose's going to do right after this session a demo of Deep Zoom 2, and he's going to show you how to build a Deep Zoom. It's actually really, really cool. So I reckon it's time for developers to embrace their Silverlight. I like that. And a company that has embraced their Silverlight is ABC. So I don't know if you guys know much about ABC, but I'm not going to talk about it. I'm going to show you what the ABC has done around Silverlight and the experiences that they've built. So let me invite Matt Moran up from the ABC to have a chat. Hey, Matt.
Thanks, Michael. Good morning. ABC Commercial is responsible for the ABC's consumer publishing and licensing businesses, which is actually a lot more fun than it sounds. And at the moment, we're working on projects on our video and music businesses. And what we needed was a media player that offered a quality viewing experience, was easy to use, and was adaptable to the different website requirements that we had. Now, the first place you're going to see what we came up with is at the ABC Shop Online. There it goes, the search page. It's not quite what I was after. This is the trouble when you use somebody else's laptop. And when you go to the ABC page, you'll be offered a preview player link. And when you click it, this is what you'll get. It's our media player. It's pretty much just a video on a light box overlay. And as you'll see, when you roll the mouse over, you get a basic set of controls. And now those controls will be there, even in full screen mode. And if you like what you're seeing and you want to see more, you have the option of browsing for related clips there so that you can keep on viewing the stuff that you're interested in. And if you're really interested in what you're seeing, you have the option of buying it. And when you click a purchase button, what gets displayed are all of the different product variants that are available. In this demo, it's just a download, but it could conceivably be a DVD or the CD soundtrack or even a T-shirt that goes with the series. And that's because what we've done is we've taken the ABC Shop's existing cart and put it inside the viewing experience. So let's say I wanted to buy that. What you'll do is you'll log on with your regular old ABC account that you've no doubt used already to buy lots and lots of stuff. This is a demo, so it doesn't know that I have been here before, but the normal shop would, of course. And there you go. It adds it to the shopping cart there. Now, you can keep browsing if you want to, or you can keep adding things to your shopping cart, but when you're ready to check out, you get a regular checkout interface here. Now, this is, as I said, the ABC Shop's cart, but we have made some efforts to streamline it for digital products. So if you haven't added any physical product, like a DVD or a CD or a book or something, then it won't prompt you for your postal or delivery options. It'll just let you get on with the business of paying for it, which is what I'm about to do now. That's, oddly enough, that's a fake credit card number, so don't try this at home. But there you go. Do the legals, confirm my order, and I'm good to go. Good, I'm glad that said it was successful. There's obviously some money left on that credit card. So what happens now is that in order to get the file, this is, I've just bought myself a download, in order to get the file onto my computer, an application, a download manager application, will install itself on my computer the first time I buy something. Now that application is based around Contiki's peer-to-peer technology, and I can show you it now, in fact. There it goes, and as you can see, there's one we prepared earlier. And now you don't have to watch the video inside that application if you don't want to. The way we've set it up is that it is possible to actually copy it to another computer a limited number of times so that you can share it around or put it onto your laptop and watch it at work if you like. Now, as you can see, that Contiki client has had an interface that's been customized so that it looks and behaves like the interface of the browser player. And in fact, the two are integrated because you can go back to the browser player and it will allow you to browse through the files that you've downloaded as well, so that you've got two ways of getting into your content, either from the browser, if that's where you are, or from the little download application that sits on your system tray there. Now, we are hoping to launch the download service to the public very soon, but you can already see the media player in action at the ABC Shop Online. We've got it there playing out preview clips for DVDs at the moment, so be sure and check that out. Thank you.
Matt. So that's cool. Isn't that cool? Like a total shopping experience built into your media player. Yeah. I think it's awesome. There you go. The guys who built it think it's awesome too. So actually, the guys who built it will be talking about how they built it in a session later on today as well. So check your agendas. I'm sure you're all booked in to see it. Exactly the architecture of the whole thing and some of the bits and pieces that they did to make it happen. So let's just change pace a little bit to my second favorite topic in the world. Did we know that Internet Explorer is in like beta, Internet Explorer 8? Yeah, you do now. So you can go to that URL, if I can get my head out of the way, and download beta 2 of Internet Explorer. Internet Explorer 8, it's actually a developer preview, so it's anyone can download it, but it's really designed to give developers an early preview of the browser, and it's specifically designed so that we can get feedback on it, all right, see what we're doing right, see what we're doing wrong. But the key things that were factored into building IE 8 were improving experience for users. You can see it all up there. I don't want to go through all the cool stuff. There's a whole bunch of stuff on the Internet Explorer site, but you know, so when you're browsing, you can get clearer indication of what sites you're on, better management of ActiveX, so the ActiveX controls run in separate contexts. They can even run at a per-site level, and if the thing crashes for whatever reason, that they crash within the browser context, and a tab context, sorry, and not within the browser context. The other area that a lot of focus went into was the developer experience. So there was this issue that came up a little while ago around predictability, right? So when you build a site that exists today, what does a developer expect is predictable? Is predictable that what has always happened always happens, or is predictable that we follow a standard and no matter what used to happen when a site was hit with IE8 following the latest standards from W3C, should it behave in exactly the same way that W3C expects it to behave, therefore breaking a whole bunch of sites that probably were adjusted so that they work in IE7 and 6? So a lot of thought, and so actually, so one of the big goals was to make sure it's CSS 2.1 compliant. So a decision was made, basically, that IE8 will be standards mode by default. That means if you have a site today that's got a doc type in the top and it's got a whole bunch of hacks in it, then it will break in IE8, unless you put a meta tag in the top. So it's something to be aware of. There's actually a whole session on IE8 as well, going through all of this in detail to get a better understanding of what all this stuff means, because I'm not going to have a lot of time to go through it. There's a whole bunch of other stuff in IE8, like web slices and activities. Better me not talk about web slices and activities. Fairfax Digital has done a lot of work around preparing for IE8, so I'll invite Mark Cohen up from Fairfax Digital to show you the stuff they've done to prepare for IE8. Mark.
Thanks, Mike. So Fairfax Digital operate what is probably one of the biggest networks in Australia of websites. The huge majority of our audience use Internet Explorer, and we really have to be ready for IE8 when it comes out. So we focused on three things. The first, as Mike says, was a meta tag. I'm going to step over to the computer and I'll show you quickly. There we go. Okay. The sites that we run are very heavily designed around using CSS and not that much about tables. So we're looking at Drive right now. Drive, before they put a meta tag on to handle the changes that IE8 would make, had a screen that looked like that, which is as bad as CSS can go. Obviously, utterly useless. If you source on Drive, you'll see that there's one line added, very quick fix, and the site is functioning, looking perfect. One of the other things that we looked at was web slices and web activities as well. Web slices are awesome because we have a lot of guys who come to the Drive because of the editorial content. It's not just a classified site. And RevHeads are very often interested in looking at content, reading articles, following the media. So what you'll see is if you hover over here, you'll see it's not coming up. Okay, our web slice is broken. I'm going to move on to the activities. Did it come up? Ah, there you go. That's the size of the screen. So you see a little thing, purple thing pop up. You can see the icon over there. The web slice is awesome. All you do is you click it. It says, there's a web slice you want to click. Do you want to install it? You say yes. It adds it up. You'll see it appear on the toolbar. There you go. And when the content changes, it actually bolds. So when people are not on your site, they get alerted that there's content that they can come in and read. And that's a real good draw card to bring people in. The way that it works is it shows a basic teaser of the article. We've got bandwidth problems. and it would actually open through. When you click it through, it'll bring you back into the site. Then we've got activities here as well. Activities are really cool because it's identifying a pattern of what people usually do. So they could be reading about cars on someone else's site, and by installing an activity, it's basically a matter of putting a simple provider in. You install it, and what you've done is we now have the ability to go and search on any site for, if we go to more activities and drive, there you go. So you can see Blue Commodore, here's the listings coming up, and it'll click straight through to search results. One of the things that's really cool on that is you'll notice that it's actually a text search. It's not the normal make model search, and so you can search for anything. We could also have been looking at some other high-profile media site, and we could have taken a car. We could have been reading an article about this particular car and shot straight through to drive. The other thing which is really cool with activities is the ones that you use are the ones that drop into the main menu, and the ones that you don't use go into the more activities. So as you use that one, it will move itself into your primary list, which is really cool. If you want to see the meta tag in action, if you go to drive and do a view source, it's the first meta tag there, you can lift it. It's the compatibility one. And that's it. Thanks.
Thank you, Mark. And if you want to actually install the activities, drive.com.au/activities, and you get the install process. And with the web slices, you install IE8, and you're ready to rock and or roll. I'm going to get out of your hair and introduce someone who actually knows stuff. Allow me to introduce Angus Logan, who is the... what are you, Angus? You are this guy. He's a senior technical product manager. He's going to talk to you about Live, pretty much, and the developer platform that Live is, rather than the stuff that you might know Live to be, the fact that Live is a developer platform. So, Angus, come on down, dude.
And thank you. It's good to be home. So I work in the Live platform team, and Windows Live is Microsoft's consumer offering for the internet. So it's our online services. Now, it's interesting to watch all of these presentations earlier, because no one's talked about the highest cost in running a website. It's basically acquisition of users. If you're running a super high volume website, then acquiring people to that website is your major cost. So how do you get more visitors? How do you get more people to come to your website to basically kind of use the things that you've got on your site? With Windows Live, what we can do is we can help developers acquire more people to their site. So we've got about 30 billion relationships in the Windows Live store that you can tap into. So as I'm on delicategenius.com, I could recommend that to someone else that I already have friended or that already trusts me. So we can acquire more users to web properties. And there's a lot of different features for this. Now, the other thing is you can't just survive on new visitors. You need to convert these visitors into residents. You need to drive deeper engagement. And you've seen a lot of this with Silverlight and a couple of other things today. But what I'm really trying to get across is if people want to, or if you want to make a successful website, you need to glue the users to your site. You need to have them coming back. You need to basically try and create the next Facebook that everyone is burning minutes on, because when you burn minutes, you refresh ads, you make more money, pays for more developers. Make sense? All right, you guys are pumped. So when you think of Windows Live, there's probably a couple of core products that we have, and this is really the consumer-focused things. This isn't Office Online or Live Mesh or any of those other capabilities that we have. But there is a ton of products that are out there that have over 400 million users every month hitting those products, hitting those services. And what we're really trying to do is change it from being Microsoft having a relationship with those 400 million people every month to having your organization in the middle. So you can tap into the audience, so the 400 million people. And I think the number is 7 million in Australia, 7 million Windows Live users every month. You can tap into that audience, you can tap into their data, and then also some technology services that we have. And I'm going to show you what a startup in Australia has done using Windows Live. There's a company called Genexus, and the team from Genexus have basically built a website that uses lots and lots of Windows Live services. So it's called the So-So Network. I'm not sure why it's called that. But last night, I went out for a kebab, and I want to show you what I did when I went for this kebab. Like, it was a fairly good kebab, and I want to drop a review on their business review website. So I'm just going to sign in here, and I'm going to use my Windows Live ID just so I don't need to go and create another identity, and I don't need to give them a different username and password, etc. So when I first signed up to this website, I gave the SoSo network permission to see all of my friends from Windows Live, to tap into that 30 billion relationships that we have. So now when I visit this site, it lists all of my friends here. It finds the intersection on this website. And I think Fairfax Media just integrated something like this on one of their properties. We've also got other things like integrating with Facebook as well, importing your Facebook friends. So I see that like the party has been brought to the website, the people I know. But I want to go and find this kebab shop that I went and got dinner at last night. So I'm just going to search for kebabs in Paddington. I can't really remember where I went. And we actually see the result set here as being in Bondi Junction. And that's the place that I went for the kebab. Now, Paddington isn't a string match to Bondi. How did we do this? Or how did the guys at Genexus do this? They used the MapPoint web service to get a geocode and then used SQL 2008 to do spatial matching. So that's a fairly interesting application of technology that makes it easy for me to be able to find the kebab shop that I went to last night. So now I'm just going to click through and drop a review or click through and see this business here. So I can go through and I can see all of the photos here. There's some videos here. I'll come back to a video in a sec. There's a map all using Microsoft Virtual Earth. They're tapping into about 15 petabytes of data that they don't need to host on their web server. They're just able to call this in from the Windows Live data center and deliver this experience to their customers. We can also look at some video here. This is a guy teaching us how to make kebabs. You see, you get it, you shake it up a little bit, and then you do the finger to the customer. So we see that there's this really rich experience. And lots of people aren't streaming video or taking user-generated content because it could be bad for their servers, because it could kind of create scale issues. All of this video, some of the photos are coming from the Windows Live data center. So they're basically taking some of our scale, some of our capabilities, and tacking that onto their website to complement it. So the next thing I just want to do really quickly is I'm just going to drop a review in super fast. The ambience is horrible, great service. I'll just drop a comment in here. And now that's been submitted. And we see all of the reviews that have been submitted. But I'm not really interested in what everyone else is doing. I just want to know what my social graph, what my friends are recommending. So from that list of friends that were pulled in from the Windows Live contact list, I can now go and filter all of this data on this application. Now, the last thing I want to show you is just how this application creates a way to pull people back in. Up here, there's a feature called Windows Live Contacts. So I can subscribe to the kebab place because it was so good. I want to be notified whenever they've got something new going on there. And when the business owner turns up, I'll just open this in Firefox. That's right, you saw it, Firefox. So I'm just going to sign in here as the business owner using a Windows Live ID. And what I can do here is I can see all of the businesses that I own. So I'll just go to the Kebab Palace. And down the bottom, I could send out an alert to all of the people that have subscribed to alert. So I could say 50 cent kebab deal. And this is going to send a Windows Live alert. And Windows Live Alerts is a multi-channel messaging framework. In the US, it does SMS. Everywhere else, it does Toast in Windows Live Messenger. So it pops up on the side of the screen. So people get a little Toast here, and then they get acquired back into the application. And it also sends email. It's a different way of engaging with people on your website. Now, the very last thing I want to show you is just here. If I go and see, let me just go and grab a review, for example. So I could go back to this website and I could see a review that was written, and I could choose to engage with that person, to become their friend, to communicate with them. So I just click on their name here, and we see all of the things they've done, their photos, their newsfeed, etc. But one of these is send IM. So instead of having an asynchronous relationship, you know where people kind of write on your wall in Facebook and then you need to wait, you get the email and you want to go back, but there isn't time, etc. So instead of doing that, what they've done is they've plugged in Windows Live Messenger. So I can click here, and I can start an IM conversation with someone that I've met from this website. So what they've done is they've acquired more visitors to their website through the social relationships. Because I'm IMing someone, I'm reminding them that they're back on this website. And then they've created deeper engagement through alerts, Silverlight streaming, the mapping capabilities. So now they've got more people and deeper engagement. And what that means is more ads and more money. So this is how all of you developers are going to be employed in a couple of years when basically everything starts getting funded by ads. Now, with that, I want to hand back to Shane Moe to talk about some designer, user experience-y kind of stuff. Thank you.
Thanks, dude. So I guess as a user experience guy, what stands out for me in what Angus was talking about is that he's talking about Windows Live as a platform rather than a delivered product. And that's really what we're here to talk to you guys about today, is providing platforms, services, and tools so that you guys can create your own unique vision, deliver on your own awesome services and products. And so I want to talk briefly about this idea of differentiated user experiences. It's a phrase that we're using a lot at Microsoft at the moment. It's not like we invented it. It's this idea that you are using your user experience to stand out from the crowd, to get stickiness and engagement in your site. Rather than just trying to differentiate on functionality, which is getting harder and harder. And what we know is that web users today are looking for more than just a passive experience of their media and content. They want to engage in a two-way conversation with the stuff they're consuming. And I can think of no organization that has embraced this two-way conversation with its audience more than Big Brother. So by now, probably most of you know that Big Brother in Australia is... The public live stream from Big Brother is delivered over Silverlight. We're really excited about that. But there's more. And so I'm going to invite Richard Lord up, who's Chief Marketing Officer from Hiro, and he's really going to tell you about the plan going forward for Big Brother and using Silverlight to create an even more engaging experience on screen.
Thanks, Shane. Thanks very much, everybody, and it's a real privilege for me to be here in front of such an esteemed crowd, and it's certainly a real privilege to have two of our great pieces of work featured in the keynote. And hopefully one of the things that you've noticed from the work that we've done for ABC and the work I'm about to show you for Big Brother is that it really is the rise of user experience. What we're finding, we've been working with Big Brother for 3 years, and obviously they're always looking for ways to improve the franchise and improve the customer engagement. So when they engaged us for Big Brother 08, I asked us to show them some new ideas and some new ways to be able to perhaps draw the users in and give them a better experience that they haven't had before. So let me just show you very quickly the sorts of things that we've been doing. Now, as Shamo said, the video experience is delivered through Silverlight. Now, Silverlight, of course, because it's a flexible, programmable, rich media environment, allows us to do some things that are pretty neat. We can control the look and feel of the video player. We can build the controls into the video player. We can embed that video player into the HTML. We can put it inside the website. But when we expand that, we start to see some of the extra capability of Silverlight in action. Silverlight is a programmable, rich media environment that allows us to integrate data, interactivity, and even things like marketing and advertising straight into the video stream that we're delivering to the customer. We can deliver high-quality video. Because the bandwidth can adapt to the video playing experience can adapt to the bandwidth, we have very high levels of control over the experience we're giving to our customers. Because it's programmable, it means we can start to put some value-added services into the viewing experience. We're not in the situation where the viewing experience is separate from the way the customers engage. We've brought those two together to a single harmonized environment. We can start to do things like look at profiles of users. We can start to call that data real-time from the website, from the real-time databases, as the users are adding their comments, their rants, their raves, and we can deliver it within the video experience. We can give them a whole pile of ability to control that experience. The controls are built into the video player. We can build interactivity into the devices and services that we use. We can build advertising in. That advertising is driven real-time out of a database into the video experience. Because the users have identified themselves, because we have data about the session, data about what they're seeing, data about what's going on, we can customize that advertising to suit the things that our advertiser, in this case Big Brother 08 and Network 10, want to deliver to their customers. It's a unique, customized, dynamic, programmable, rich media experience that changes the way that our customers will engage with a Big Brother asset and deliver value to our customer in the long term. I've been in this game for as long as it's been around. We're the biggest and oldest digital services company in Australia. And I can tell you, this stuff's going to change the world. Thanks very much for your time.
Thanks, Steve. So yeah, a great example of how differentiating on the user experience creates a stickier experience, a more engaged experience, and delivers more value for sponsors and advertisers. So deliver those differentiated user experiences. We've talked about the platforms and services that Microsoft provides to allow you guys to do that. And in the dying moments, I want to talk about the tools, and specifically about Expression. So Microsoft's vision going forward is to provide you guys with a consistent set of tools and skills so that you can deliver experiences across multiple platforms, multiple devices, multiple surfaces. And that strategy is really acknowledging the role of creative and technical, of developers and designers in the process of delivering these services, and acknowledging that those people work differently. And that's where our tool sets come in. So Visual Studio is the developer environment that you guys know well and love. Expression Studio is, well, it's a year old now, but it's our new suite of design tools. And the important thing is that these products are designed to interact and help you guys to collaborate and work more productively together. So we're very excited to announce the Australian availability of Expression Studio 2 today here at Remix. You guys are all getting a free copy, and you are amongst the first people in the world to actually have your hands on a DVD of this product. There's some stuff in your bags about Expression, but I'm just going to quickly point out some of the points in the product suite very quickly. So Expression Web 2 adds new features like PHP support, whatever that is. drag and drop support for Silverlight and Flash experiences. Native support for Photoshop and Photoshop layers. Expression Design adds support for layers, as well as new slicing tools for exporting your comps in different formats. Expression Blend 2 has new animation tools as well as productivity enhancements in the UI. Expression Media supports new formats like RAW. It now supports geotagging and also has new features for sharing catalogs between designers across Mac and PC. And lastly, Expression Encoder has new features, new editing features, new live encoding features, as well as features for publishing media direct to the web. So we're very excited about Expression Studio 2, and Tim Adlin, who's out here from Redmond, especially for Remix in Australia, is going to be doing a session later on the day where he's going to take you through all this stuff. Two quick announcements. First is the Expression Professional subscription. So from July, we're launching this alternative way to keep up to date with the latest Expression and related product set. So this subscription is a more cost-effective way to keep the latest stuff on your desktop. It includes Expression, includes Visual Studio, Office, Visio, very important for our designers. And also, I'd like to highlight Parallels there for all our designers working on the Mac. The other thing I'll quickly announce is the DreamSpark program. So Expression is going to be included in DreamSpark from September. If you don't know DreamSpark, basically every tertiary student in Australia from September will have free access to the entire suite of Expression Studio tools, as well as Visual Studio and a whole bunch of other Microsoft products. So that's my quick wrap-up of what's happening with Expression.
All right, that's enough. go buy a bunch of product. So we wanted to wrap up because it's this time. Hopefully you guys are as excited as we are about the stuff that you can do. I reckon the stuff ABC's done, the stuff that with Big Brother, that is all within the reach of .NET developers and people who use the Expression suite. So I reckon we've shown the wow. It is now time for the how. So you're going to spend the rest of the day learning how to build this stuff, how to do this stuff. It's a very practical, educational kind of day. Before we set you out on your journey to do the how, though, I might introduce to you your guide to the planet of Microsoft. Fionnuala Crowe, who will go through some stuff. Thank you.
Wow, it's been a very exciting morning, particularly for the Remix team to see all of this come to fruition. So my name is Fionnuala Crowe, and I'm the marketing manager for developers and designers at Microsoft. So you have your own marketing manager. So I just wanted to welcome you and thank you for your support. We're really overwhelmed that we've had another two sold-out Remix events. I think our management thought we were a bit mad when we said, let's run two and let's get about 700 delegates. And we've done that, so thank you for your support. Now, it is a sold-out event here today, so there's just a few things I want to draw your attention to that will make your day more comfortable. We've got two rooms where the tracks are taking place. We've got two tracks, a creative track and a technical track. Now, the rooms do interchange between tracks. So this room is the Coles Theatre. Right up the stairs on your right-hand side is the smaller Target Theatre. As the sessions are booked out, particularly in the smaller room, we would appreciate it if you can try and stick to the sessions that you chose in registration. If you do choose to move, just have a quick word with the person who's monitoring the door in the smaller room. So apart from that, you will have received a little very eco-friendly remix bag this morning coming in, full of leaflets and so on. There's one thing that I'd like to draw your attention to, which is the evaluation form. We really like to know how you feel about these events and about Microsoft in general, and it helps us improve and it helps us get better. It also helps us understand if we have done something well, so don't be afraid to say something good as well. At the end of the day, when you're leaving, you will get, as Shane said, you'll be the first in the world almost to receive Expression 2 Studio when you return your completed evaluation form. If you do need to leave a little bit earlier in the afternoon, just pop to the registration desk and have a chat with them there. The other thing is we've got a bunch of Microsoft experts here today, both from Microsoft and our Microsoft Valued Professionals, and also our speakers, some of whom you've heard this morning, and some of whom will be presenting during the day. During the breaks, you'll find us there. We really want to answer your questions. We want to engage with you. I'll be up there myself, and I'll be looking to get feedback from you about how we can do things better. Actually, I forgot to mention as well, I've got a Twitter too. It's Finulation. You can follow me on that, but not today because I've got a really bad phone with me. I won't mention which brand it is. The other thing is, at the end of the day, I know I'll be dying for a drink, so we're having a bit of a happy hour down in the exposition hall. So before I let you go, I know I'm the only thing between you guys and a cup of tea, well-deserved cup of tea for your attention. I just want to thank some really fantastic people who've supported Remix, and they are our sponsors. I think we've got a slide with our sponsors. Click, click. It's okay. It's first one of the day. So these are our sponsors, and I really want to call them out. We wouldn't be able to run Remix, particularly two Remixes in Australia, without their support. Now, they've all put together some great offers. There's an exposition area where all of the meals will be served today. I know that there's, for one offer, there's a holiday going at one of the booths. You can go out there and find out. Some of our partners have training vouchers, and there's lots going on out there. So please support them, engage with them, and they too have lots of experts in the industry. So without further ado, please invite you to join us for morning tea. The sessions will start pretty much on time, so it's going to be a 15-minute morning tea. And good luck with the rest of the day, and enjoy.